dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Freedom, of course, is hotly contested in lots of different places. It's not just on battlefields overseas. It's not even in foreign lands. It's happening here in America, too. And one of the most volatile places in which freedom is being contested at the moment, and I would argue suppressed to a greater and greater degree all the time, is on America's college and university campuses. We are very privileged to have with us for a full hour of conversation a man we interviewed recently for the first time in altogether too long, and invited him back, and he's graciously agreed to give us a full hour of his time to discuss many of the topics that are relevant to what's happening both on campus but also elsewhere in America today. His name is Professor Jason Hill. He has a PhD with DePaul University, where he is the Honors Distinguished Faculty and Director of the Teaching Practicum. He is an author of numerous important publications, including most recently, We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People. It is a delight to be able to pick his brains about, among other things, some of his recent writings at Front Page Magazine, and more generally, some of his experiences in the war for the free world, as I call it. Dr. Jason Hill, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
I want to start by, I hope, establishing sort of the context for a lot of what you say and think and write. Namely, your experience as an immigrant to America. It seems to me that you exemplify the best in the qualities that have enriched this country enormously over many generations of people who've come here willingly and because they wanted to experience and benefit from and give back to a land of opportunity, the home of the free and the brave. This is an impressive story in microcosm, but I think particularly in your splendid book, We Have Overcome, you have really laid out why it should both be, well, encouraged as much as possible and inform those of us who take so much for granted because we didn't come here. We're born here. We were incredibly blessed to do so, but we do, it seems, often ignore what you admire and respect and encourage the rest of us to do as well. Tell us sort of your story and your perspective, if you would, Dr. Hill.
Well, I came here at the age of 20 as a legal immigrant to pursue an education, to get an undergraduate degree, and to go on subsequently to earn a PhD through a scholarship, which I did earn, and to establish myself as a writer and a public intellectual. So I came and legally with some members of my family, my mother and my grandmother, and, you know, worked very, very hard. I worked up to three jobs to put myself through school, and I demanded nothing of America except that the country placed no obstructions in my path towards securing my future. And I love this great republic. I thought America from way back in Jamaica, which in the country in which I was born and raised, was the greatest republic that had ever existed on the face of the earth. And I have to say that I've never had to revise that conception or appraisal of America for many, many reasons. One is that this is an unprecedented phenomenon, an experiment in which citizenship is theoretically and practically open to anyone. It's the first country in which citizenship is not based on criteria of blood, lineage, religious affiliation, a race, ethnicity. You pledge a set of thin allegiances to the Republic, and you're free to create a life plan of your own. After being in the academy for 23 years, I had just grown very, very tired of what I thought was the growing America phobia, particularly sponsored by those on the far left, that saw America as intrinsically bigoted, an imperialistic, racist, xenophobic society. And I had adduced myself as evidence of the utter stupidity and falsity of this kind of narrative that was being spawned by the left. And so I decided to write a book, We Have Overcome, an immigrant's letter to the American people, which is dedicated to the American people as both an inoculation against the poisonous, toxic narrative spawned by the far left, and also as a celebration of America and the exceptionalism of this country. I think people are way too afraid to say that America is an exceptionalist country and that her people are an exceptional, unprecedented people. And so the book is both an inoculation against the poisonous narrative of that spawns Americophobia, and more importantly, a celebration of what makes this country great, why it has worked for immigrants such as myself, why we should fight against the cult of a grievance, the cult of entitlement, and the cult of victimization and victimology.
Give us a sense, just in the most succinct form you can, because we're going to have to take a break here in a moment. What is it that makes America great, Dr. Hill?
What makes America great is that this is the only country in which, and I've been to about 70 countries around the world, for traveling for my work, giving lectures. This is the only country in which you can reverse the accidents of your birth, no matter what they are. In my book, I write about an untouchable in India, a Dalit who came here, who was so despised and in his country that people would wipe the streets behind themselves after they walked. He came here. Most Americans in the South didn't even know what an untouchable was and didn't care. This man went on to become an architect. I write about a Vietnamese peasant who came here, Thai, who came here legally, left his parents, who were illiterate peasants back in Vietnam, and started his own Vietnamese restaurant. What makes this country exceptional is that we are each, in some sense, assigned a station in life. And America gives us the opportunity to fashion a vision for our lives, of what we want to become. It is a country predicated on aspirational identities. That is, one might have been born poor, one might have been born of a particular station in life that doesn't fit or suit the vision one has of one's life. And America says, you can come here and you can make, through grit, tenacity, resilience, honor, and hard work, you can become the vision of what you have for your life. And you can achieve socioeconomic parity with your compatriots. There are very few countries in the world, Europe is, and I like Europe as a continent, so I'm not bashing Europe, but Europe is one example, and Asia is another example of countries predicated on tribalism, on lineage, on belonging, on nepotism. This country opens up its doors to both Americans and to foreigners who have been vetted properly and have passed the criteria for admission, and says, you can become that which you aspire to become. It caters to an aspirational identity.
Jason Hill, we have to pause for just a second. I want to come back on exactly that point. You are an exceptional addition to this country, let me just say, and we'll be right back with considerably more with Dr. Jason Hill of DePaul University right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour with a most remarkable man, an educator by training, but a man who exemplifies in his person, in his public speaking, in his writings, both in places like Front Page Magazine and his several books, including most recently, We Have Overcome, an immigrant's letter to the American people. An incredible wealth of thoughtful, informed, and quite courageous commentary on the challenges of our time. And I am so delighted to have him as a friend, as well as a much, much valued guest for this program. Dr. Hill, You, in the previous segment, were talking about several things that are endlessly served up by the left, as you've mentioned, and what I think of as their partners in a, for want of a better phrase, red-green axis, and that would be the Islamists or Sharia supremacists, I think is the most accurate way to describe them. These turn quite a bit at the moment on the whole idea that this is a racist society, that it has always been, and notwithstanding the Civil War, notwithstanding the Civil Rights Movement, notwithstanding, well, the election of Barack Obama and so much more, it is still a racist nation in which identity politics trump everything, and we must, well, make reparations, and we must expiate our sins, and on and on. You're a black man from Jamaica. You have, I'm sure, had experiences in which you have been poorly treated because you are a black man. But speak to us about this racist narrative, its accuracy in depicting America, and the damning quality of that indictment in terms of where we go from here.
Well, I must say that, you know, after having lived in this country for 32 years, yes, I have experienced my fair share of racism. I lived in the Deep South for 8 years in the mid-1980s, 85 to 92. I lived in Atlanta. And I did live in Ku Klux Klan County for because it was very cheap, and I was a poor student struggling. And but I must say that, you know, there is this idea that it is the right or conservatives that have some sort of coercive monopoly on racism. And most of the racism that I experienced in this country really was directed to me by the far left, because for many reasons. One is, you know, I was a conservative liberal, and now I identify as a conservative independent, but I was a libertarian. I went through various incarnations of self-identification, but one thing I did not have was a victim story. So because I held the wrong ideological position for a black man to have, I received the ire of many leftist professors on campus who just didn't know what to make of me. So let me say that racism runs across the gamut of American society, both the left and the right, and both the multiculturalists and the leftist identity politickers, I call them. The thing about it is that whenever I experienced racism, I never, ever thought that the experience of a particular form of injustice conferred upon me a permanent victim status. I didn't want anybody expropriating my agency and taking care of me. I think in America we have, at this point, enough legal infrastructures that can redress problems of racism. And I simply faced racism whenever I faced it. I took the steps necessary to call it out, to address it, and I simply moved on with my life. And the idea somehow that this country is intrinsically bigoted with no form of redress for people who have experienced it, and that the majority of Americans are intrinsically racist, is ridiculous. I mean, empirically, that's just false. We have a country of foreigners. We have a country of immigrants. It's probably the least xenophobic country on the face of the earth. And there is a poisonous narrative that is cultivated that paints as permanent victims anyone who experiences racism. I think what I tried to do in the book was to show that the immigrants whom I portrayed were all people of color who never allowed their experiences of any form of racism to unsettle the narrative or to compromise in any meaningful way the narrative or the life plan that they had, I should say, that they had constructed for themselves. America, first and foremost, is a country that invites all of its immigrants and all of its citizens to be co-authors in the script of what it means to be an American. We know that that script has changed over time. There was a time when this country was ruled by supremacy of white ideology, of white supremacy. We're not a white supremacist country anymore because we don't have an official ideology that promotes the white race as superior in a way that we once did. So we have progressed over time, and people can't see the historical progression in this country, which is very, very problematic.
Well, and I think it's a deliberate strategy to deny it that is at work here. But let me just drill down on that. You have acknowledged that there was a time when white supremacist ideas and ideologies were operating here. That is, of course, a piece of evidence in the criticism. It's now being promoted by the New York Times endlessly as their new, you know, attack on President Trump, this 1619 project that commemorates the arrival of the first black slaves in the United States. But what do you say to those who argue that the founders, many of them, not all, but many of them were slaveholders, and they essentially chose to ignore the clear meaning of their founding documents that talked about all men being created equal because they held slaves and in some cases, you know, treated them badly. Does this in fact suggest, as we're being told it should, that the country is indeed irremediably flawed and that it continues to be the case that white supremacists are running amok and are the greatest threat that we're facing internally, I guess possibly second only to global warming? Just walk us through all of that, if you would, sir.
Well, let me get to the first part of the question about the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers created an unprecedented republic, the greatest government that probably has ever existed on the face of the planet. This country was created with a moral birth defect called slavery. And I see the Founding Fathers as men of their times who were very contradictory in the way that they, let's just say, the way that they saw humanity being allocated among different groups of people. They made a moral compromise to get this republic off the ground. The moral compromise, of course, was slavery. It was an egregious moral compromise, but it was still a moral compromise that got the republic started. And many of the slave owners themselves, Thomas Jefferson, for example, whom I regard as a great co-founder of this country, were futurists also, Frank. They were futurists who were not able to transcend the specificities of their times, meaning their own lack of a political machinery or a method of freeing all persons or seeing all persons as free. But they were futurists. The reason that I, as a black man, can hold a PhD and lecture predominantly to white students in this country, the reason that we could have had a black president who served two terms, was precisely because the Constitution was created in such a way that without being a radical judicial activist, the Founding Fathers were able to implement a document and implement a form of government that would transcend the limitations of even their own vision. So when my students say to me that they're not going to study, for example, the Federalist Papers, or they're not going to study Common Sense by Thomas Paine because he was a white nationalist and he was a white racist and he was a white supremacist, I say to them, where do you get the emancipatory vocabulary? Where do you get the moral vocabulary, first of all, to make such an utterance to your professor that you are not going to study any of the Founding Fathers or any of the figures who influenced the Founding Fathers, like the philosopher John Locke, who happens to be my favorite philosopher, one of my favorite philosophers? I said, we are the legatees, all people of color and all persons, whether they're gay liberationists, women's liberals, whomever, we're all the legatees of a great tradition that was bequeathed to us, that gave us these moral vocabularies. These moral vocabularies came from somewhere. And so I think that people who get stuck in a historical narrative without being able to look at the way that our society has progressed, just look at the way since the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed, at the enormous progress that has been made in terms of race relations and the treatment of blacks, are empirically dishonest, are engaging in willed self-deception, or are just merely unthinking social ballasts who prefer to ostensibly point of a time in American history when it was not a purely just society or even remarkably justice-oriented towards, let's say, blacks, and fail to see the progress. There has been progress. progress has been made. And I think it's just a very, very unfortunate when people from all parts of the world come here and use themselves as evidence of the fact that America is a progressive. And when I say progressive, I don't mean in the way that liberals use progressive. I mean in the sense that it is a country that is constantly bent towards justice.
And Dr. Hill, we have to pause again. We'll be right back with much more with Dr. Jason Hill. You can find his writings these days at Front Page Magazine or in several important books, including most recently, We Have Overcome, an immigrant's letter to the American people. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to be able to say to you, and I think to our guest, Dr. Jason Hill, that this is as much fun as I get to have, is to talk with such a free-range intellect, a man of great courage, thoughtful, informed, and passionate about his love for our country and his recognition of its imperfections as well as its great strengths. And we've been talking a bit about several of them, his own experiences with racism, the challenges of overcoming some of our past history, but the incredible, exceptional quality of a country that does self-correct and does enable opportunity for all. And I wanted to pick up on something that you've written about, Dr. Hill, back on the 14th of August in Front Page Magazine, for which you write as a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And that is a piece entitled The Cultural and Economic Jihadism in America. And it makes a number of really important points about who is waging that jihadism and to what end. And I'd like you to share your insights with our guests, with our audience, if you would.
Well, I think that there are people on the far left who are forming really unholy alliances with, let's just say, Islamic forces in this country, Islamists, jihadists, openly, unapologetically, in order to, let's just say, get the Muslim vote. Right. Let's just put it in plain terms. Julian Castro and Sanders have agreed to address a North American Islamic Society in August, on August 31st. And one would ask, why would two members of the left agree to speak to an organization that is linked to terror cells and terrorist organizations? And I think this is for political expediency. I think when I talk about cultural and economic jihadism, there are two points I want to make. Let's deal with the first one, cultural jihadism. There is a move in this country to establish parallel legal systems, that is to establish Sharia law as a competitor with objective American law as outlined by our Constitution. I think these movements are growing. I think one of the evidence that we see is the proliferation, for example, of Students for Justice in Palestine, which is on 200 university campuses across this country, which is funded by the AMP, American Muslims for Palestine. They're the surrogates of Hamas on campus, where they have faculty and professors who act as advisors for them. They have been known to engage in acts of terrorism on campus and to psychologically and physically coerce and intimidate professors. These movements are largely sponsored by leftist organizations. And I think we have to be very, very careful that in the name of diversity and tolerance, viewpoint toleration and ideological toleration, that we do not in any way support those organizations. And I'm a big defender of the First Amendment, but we do not defend organizations that are empirically, physically linked to acts of terrorism. And I think what we're seeing in this country is not just Islam's position of the culture in terms of the proliferation of Middle Eastern studies and Palestinian ethnic studies organizations on college campuses. We are also seeing the patronization on the part of the far left and the not so far left of these organizations that's seeping into our culture and normalizing a certain kind of ideology in the name of toleration. That is Sharia law and certain forms or expressions of jihadism, where we have one of the founders of the Students for Justice in Palestine, and I think your listeners should know that this person called for a jihadist movement in the United States of America, right? He makes no apologies about this. And when I talk about economic jihadism, I'm really talking about the idea of fundamentally changing the economic configurations of this country, which is one oriented towards free market capitalism. And when you have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders saying we are democratic socialists, and people don't understand what socialism really, really means. It means really the nationalization of the mind. It means taking away, appropriating private property to such an extent, above such a certain threshold, that it becomes an infringement on the liberties of individual people. That is the expropriation of private property to such an extent that we can no longer speak rationally about private ownership in this country. And that is being normalized. When politicians like Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez talk about socialism, Americans have to understand that it's not a fact that it's just not in our political DNA, but that socialism is legalized theft of private property by the government. And the normalization of this kind of rhetoric, where people are promised free this, free that, free education, free healthcare, without asking the question, financed by whom and by what method? I think just to break it down, we have to realize that private property is a material application of the operations of the mind. And when we're talking about expropriating and nationalizing, which is what is going to be the logical terminus of socialism, of private property, we're talking about nationalization of the person's brain. The question is each person an end in him or herself entitled to the outcome of his efforts, the material outcome of his efforts? And when the state says, no, you don't, the primary ownership of that is communal, then that is legalized theft. That is expropriation of the mind and nationalization of the brain.
It's so important. And again, it's concealed to varying degrees with terms like democratic socialism or free stuff, as you say, or this red-green business, because, you know, the notion that people who hate homosexuals and women's libbers and Jews and apostates or non-believers or songwriters or what have you are able to make common cause with people whose political base is substantially comprised, at least in the sort of leading echelons, of exactly those communities. It boggles the mind, and one wonders, to what end is this common cause being made by the red-green axis?
Well, the common end, I think, Frank, is a complete annihilation and destruction of Western civilization and the complete destruction of America as we know it. These people on the Palestinian Students for Justice, the jihadists, the postmodernists in universities that have run amok.
The cultural Marxists, and on and on.
The cultural Marxists, the multiculturalists, the identity politickers, the advocates of identity politics, the post-structuralists, those who have declared that reason itself is a creation of white imperialist racists used as a tool to exploit people of color. These people have as their goal, let us make no mistake about it, and I speak with a certain kind of authority, having taught in humanities and the social sciences, but mostly the humanities for 23 years, are haters of Western democracy. This is not hyperbole. They want to refashion society.
Fundamentally transform America is the way President Obama put it, of course, on the eve of his first election.
Fundamentally transform America, which is why they have no problem making alliances with the jihadists, with the Islamists, with the radical Muslims, which is why universities have no problem accepting millions of dollars from countries like Saudi Arabia, like Qatar, or Qatar, however you pronounce it, and always use the English pronunciation.
Yeah. Qatar.
Qatar. And accepting, but the administrative bodies of these universities are in cahoots, in collusion with the students, with the professors, to radically transform Western civilization, to destroy the canonical texts that have survived the test of time, that have communicated universal and objective truths about human nature, to radically eradicate these texts from the canon. We have to see that this is not a grassroots movement, or these are not grassroots movements springing up organically across campuses. These are strategically well-planned, well-thought-out conceptions of ways to destroy America as we know it, to destroy American way of life. And the way that you do that, of course, is by destroying the foundation of America, which is America's part and parcel of Western, a great contributor to Western civilization. But to destroy the foundations of Western civilization itself, to criminalize Western civilization as an evil, thuggish, imperialistic, colonial construct that has contributed nothing but evil to this earth.
That white supremacist, and xenophobic and racist and bigoted and all the rest of it in there. The point that you've sort of alluded to there, but I want to just underscore for our audience, is you have personally been subjected to the wrath of these sorts of forces on your own college campus and elsewhere, as you've spread the word around the country and indeed around the world, Dr. Hill. And again, it's one of the things that I find so remarkable about you, so admirable about you, and what makes it such a pleasure to have you on our program to speak truthfully and clearly, unemotionally, and I think dispassionately about certain hard realities. And those who would suppress you, as they would suppress me, or for that matter, as they would suppress any of us who disagree with their political agenda, need to be understood to be the perpetrators of outrages here, not we who are attacked by them endlessly. Dr. Hill, we have to pause for just one more second. When we come back, I want to venture into some as yet unexplored but very important territory with you, more on the remarkable insights and important contributions to our public discourse of Dr. Jason Hill, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our fourth and final installment of this special interview with Dr. Jason Hill of DePaul University. He is, as I've mentioned, the author of We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Letter to the American People, and numerous articles, particularly of late, in Front Page Magazine, to which he contributes as a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is basically acquainting us with the challenges of our time as he sees them on his own campus and others, and through the prism of his experience as an immigrant in this country. And I find it absolutely riveting. I wanted to come back to something that we touched on there at the end, though, if I could with you, Dr. Hill, and that is the vitriolic criticism to which you have been subjected at DePaul and I think elsewhere. What precipitated it, and what prompted you to take on some of these shibboleths from the left and their Islamist friends?
Well, I wrote an article in April in The Federalist about the moral right of Prime Minister Netanyahu to annex what's called West Bank, which is really properly should be called Judea and Samaria. Israel fought a defensive war against Jordan, among other countries, the Six-Day War, And that land properly belongs to Israel. Israel, I argued, should have annexed the West Bank right after the war, but took as its problem and its moral responsibility the Palestinian people, the Jordanian Arabs who call themselves Palestinians. I subsequently also went on in the article to say that Israel has every right to notice that the majority of Palestinians vote terrorist organizations into power, Hamas and the PA, Fatah, Palestinian Authority, the PLO, Fatah, both of which have charters that advocate the obliteration of Israel and the expulsion of Jewry from the area. In the case of Hamas, Charter 7, Article 7 calls for the establishment of a global caliphate. I see Israel as our alter ego in the United, in the Middle East. I see Israel as an ethical state that is the only technological civilization, democratic technological civilization, amidst a bunch of primitive and barbaric nations that are threats to U.S. national security and that are threats to Israel. I think Israel is an ethical state. It's the only state that practices religious reciprocity in that area, where Christians and other people and other people from different faiths can come free to practice their religion. It is the only state in which LGBTQ sexual asylees can seek asylum in the Middle East, Israel. And I think Israel ought to be seen in ethical terms. When I published this article, though, a campaign was led by the Students for Justice in Palestine, the College Democrats, the Young Socialists, Students Against Incarceration, to have me terminated and to have me censured. Subsequently, I was censured by the acting provost and my faculty council, who described me as a racist, xenophobic writer advocating war crimes against the Arab people and genocide against the Palestinian people, which has caused, I think, irredeemable damage to my reputation. But I care about these things. I'm driven by my convictions, by my moral principles, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, it is painful to observe what's happened to you. And I think that it's to your great credit that you are unbowed and you are pressing forward and you are, in fact, continuing to take on some of these, well, shibboleths, as I say, that are served up and force-fed now to us on campus in particular. One of which I believe you have thoughtfully addressed is this question of what's been called transphobia. Front Page Magazine on the 24th of September, you described this as something that needs to be discussed despite some of the taboos to such a discussion. And let me just say, you've approached this, which makes it all the more extraordinary, I guess, in this time of ours, as an avowed homosexual man. So tell us about what this phenomenon is, as you see it, and how, in very practical terms, it is complicating the work that, well, you, among others, are now trying to do in educating young people beset with questions of gender identity and which pronouns to be using and the most dire of consequences if somehow you fall afoul of this agenda.
Well, yeah, I do speak as a gay man who considers himself a cisgendered gay male. I mean, I'm 100% male and in my gender orientation. But that's besides the point. I think that what disturbs me is that a very, very small percentage of people who identify as trans, that is, as either advocate an idea that gender identity is fluid or identify as male or female in spite of their chromosomal markers, that such a small percentage are basically hijacking our educational system where we're transing the curriculum. And such a small minority of people should make a couple of claims. One, that they're subjected to national phobia, which I don't think they are. I think the very fact that in universities across this country, you can get in trouble for calling someone he or she instead of violating and committing all sorts of grammatical infelicities by calling them they, that the fact that such individuals have and are beginning to have a coercive grip on our curriculum where certain canonical texts cannot be taught because the authors themselves are gendered in a particular way that are offensive to the sensibility of trans people needs to be addressed. And I wanted to say that in the case of what is perceived as transphobia in this country, the situation is a lot more complex. Frank, I think whether you're male, female, gay, straight, I think I've observed that there's a crisis in masculinity in this country. There's a war against men in this country. And we have the sort of egregious terms like toxic masculinity being bandied about and accepted as normal, when it is men who have created civilization. Male figures, gay or straight, have created and contributed enormously to Western civilization, to American civilization. And the idea that somehow masculinity intrinsically is inimical and anathema to the rights and freedom and liberties of all persons simply has to be contested. So I wrote this article in order to show that when people talk about transphobia, I think they're responding to a lot of things that are going on beneath the surface. One is that in the case of trans women who still have some of their male apparatus intact and some female apparatus intact, I think that society basically is faced with something that is a horror in medical terms, that is a hermaphrodite. And the normalization of the hermaphrodite, which is a very medical rarity, that is someone born with both male and female genitalia, that the normalization of this kind of rare phenomenon in medical occurrences, is striking people on a psychological level that allows them to react a certain way that is quite, I think, understandable. But you know, the most important thing I really wanted to get across in this article is that this crisis in masculinity is only being deepened and worsened by the promulgation of the idea that most people conceive of their identities in fluid terms. I don't think this is the case. I don't think that the spectrum notion that is being promulgated by trans activists, and I think they're mostly trans activists as opposed to trans individuals themselves, is such a widespread phenomenon. Most people, I think, are situated, whether they're gay or straight, in a particular gendered identity as male or female that correspond to their chromosomal markers. I want to say also that we should, you know, this is a country that respects, that aspires to respect the dignity and the rights of all persons, and that trans people should be treated with the same kind of dignity and respect as all persons who have committed no crimes against another individual. But when you're trying to politicize your agenda and impose the agenda of a small minority of people and mainstream that agenda, I think there are widespread implications that are very, very, let's just say, un-American and inimical to what this country stands for.
Jason Hill, I hope that you will continue to return to our microphones and allow us to learn from you, and hopefully to teach others from your insights as well. Keep up that great work, sir, at DePaul University and at Front Page Magazine, and of course at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and whenever we can with us. God bless you, and keep up the good work. We'll talk with you soon, and I hope the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.